Hey, I got some news for you guys. I got an email yesterday that I got booked on C-SPAN this weekend.
Nice. Congrats.
That's amazing. Yeah. The mothership is calling mm-hmm. you home too.
Exactly. Because Jen, you've been on C-SPAN, right?
I have. I've been on Washington Journal. What are you going to be on?
I'm going to be on Washington Journal as well.
Awesome. Yeah, that's a fun one. They let me say whatever I wanted. They did not in any way tell me anything was off limits or in. Yeah, they were awesome. So yeah, you can just be you. Don't worry about it.
I've been on C-SPAN before. I did stand-up comedy on C-SPAN one time. So all three of us have been on C-SPAN. We're very cool.
I know it is a dorky thing, but when I walked in and sat in the chair and I had the Capitol, like the window, the famous window, they let me sit in the chair. And it was honestly one of the coolest things I've ever done.
So, Heaton, you did stand up on C-SPAN?
Yeah, I did stand up on C-SPAN one time. Cause I was doing stand up for a political event, like a debate, for the Soho Forum in New York City. And it was going to be broadcasting on C-SPAN. And then I sent out an email to a bunch of people in my newsletter. That's like, guys, I made it. I'm now a C-SPAN comedian. And I meant that sarcastically, but I got a bunch of emails from people that were like, we knew you could do it. Like you've finally reached the height of your career, Heaton. And I was like, wait a minute. No, like, I'm going to do more. C-SPAN's great, but I'm definitely going to do more comedy than C-SPAN. Let's not, like, it was kind of a joke, but anyway, I've been funny on C-SPAN.
Yeah. But not, you're not, you haven't been on Washington Journal though.
No. I've never had C-SPAN come to me. I've just had them. I've been on C-SPAN, but I've never sat in the chair. You guys are cool kids. I'm just waiting downstairs in the lobby eating snacks while you guys do fun stuff with the hosts.
Awkward.
Yeah. Yeah.
Ladies and gentlemen, my name is Justin Robert Young from Cheyenne, Wyoming.
I'm Jen Briney, still in Krakow, Poland.
And I'm Andrew Heaton, coming to you from Edinburgh, Scotland.
And we're not wrong on this edition of the program. We are going to be not wrong about EU banning Russian tourists, about the Iran nuclear deal amidst a possible and attempted assassinations. And we will hear from you guys as always. But first, Heaton, you look very, very dapper. You look resplendent.
Thank you very much. I do look resplendent. I have been described as erudite by multiple parties while I'm here. I'm having so much goddamn fun. I stay out till 2:30, 3:30 every morning, hanging out with new degenerate comedian friends. And then I sleep till 10 because I can, because I'm hours ahead of everybody in America. By the way, it turns out I don't need caffeine if I wake up at 10 because all you morning people are goddamn liars holding everybody back. Turns out biorhythms are real and you should wake up when you feel good and then you don't have to literally give yourself stimulants to fit in society. So everything's tip top. And then I work out of the Royal Scots Club. I think I mentioned this to you guys last week. And this nice group of gentlemen in their 80s and 90s invited me to their men's discussion group. So I put on this nice suit and rocked up and talked to the older Scots. Scottish gentlemen.
Well, at least your biorhythms haven't left you bizarrely defensive.
No, you morning people, I'm going to die on this hill. All you morning people, this is your problem, morning people. You guys all think you're just better. That's what you think. You just think you're just inherently better.
What are you talking about?
And you say dumb shit like, well, you know, you should just go to bed earlier. That's your, if you just went to bed earlier, you'd wake up earlier and then you could be a good person like me. And then it's like my response, hey, morning people, I'll give you $500 if you can sleep till 11:30 a.m. Oh, can you not do it? You're welcome to stay up as late as you'd like. Oh, you can't because biorhythms are real. Morning people, this is the privilege no one talks about. This is the thing I, Andrew Heaton, fearlessly tackle that other people are too afraid to discuss. And it's the privilege of morning people in our post-industrial society.
We're not the privileged ones, the ones that get to sleep till 11. No. Like, we're not, it's not us that are privileged. It's them, the ones that are.
It's not designed for us, Jen.
Drugging themselves to get to work.
a stunning sideswipe to the Rise and Grind crowd. Jen, do you have any straw men that you would like to puncture here on the podcast before we get started?
No. No, I already pissed off all of Middle America last week, so how about I just be nice today? I think that's how I'm going to go with it.
All right. I get to be the heel of this episode. Very good.
Let's start with whether or not either of you are going to see any Russians before you leave the friendly confines of Europe. Thousands of Russians have flocked to Europe on short-term visas since the country invaded Ukraine. Some obviously sought an escape from repression, while the normal migration of summer Russian tourists have also been part of it. Now, some European politicians are calling for an end to the short-term visas that allow Russians to holiday in the European Union as the war in Ukraine rages on. Countries including Ukraine, obviously, Estonia, Latvia, Finland, and the Czech Republic have called for the EU to limit or block short-term Schengen visas from Russia in protest of their country's invasion, which is now 6 months on. Stop issuing tourist visas to Russian was the Estonian prime minister's tweet last week. He added, visiting hashtag Europe is a privilege and not a human right. This has met with pushback from German Chancellor Olaf Scholz, who rejected the call, saying a blanket ban on visas for Russians was hard to imagine. Jen, this was the topic that you wanted to talk about. So my question to you is, is the West running out of ways to punish Russia? Like, because this feels like some kind of bottom of the barrel stuff.
Yeah, this does feel pretty extreme. And it's been fascinating to be here this summer and to watch it gain momentum. I just want to take a quick second, though, just to explain, because I know not everyone understands what Schengen is. Even though we have these five countries that you listed, thank you for doing that, that are really pushing for a ban on Russian tourists, the Schengen area is pretty much all of Europe. And so what they are asking to do is to ban Russians from pretty much all of Europe for tourism reasons. So, you know, because they have this Schengen area, like I believe it's Estonia, they decided that they're not going to let Russians enter. But the Russians, because it's a borderless place, once you get into Schengen, they can pretty much go wherever they want, you know? And that's why I was able to visit you guys in Germany and like no one even checked my passport because I was just in Schengen. So that's the significance of what they're asking to do. They're basically trying to block Russians from half the continent. And I first heard about this actually with you guys, with our surprise Ukrainian guest Tanya. And I don't know, I don't remember if it was on the air or off, but she was the first one that I heard advocate for this quite passionately. And she's still advocating for it on her Instagram stories. And I kind of understand it from a Ukrainian's perspective that you want to punish the people that are doing this to you. But it's been disturbing to me to watch the governments then get on board with this idea. And I feel like it would be so counterproductive to do. My goal with all of my discussions of this, if I'm advocating for anything, it's to end the war as fast as possible. I do think the Russian people have a role to play in that. And so the strategy with this is punish the Russian people, and that will make them want to overthrow Putin and stop the war. That's kind of the theory behind it. Where I personally am an example of being able to travel being what makes someone clue into what their government is doing. So what I mean is in 2003, I was a dumb kid. I was 20. I was traveling in Europe and we started a war. I had voted for George W. Bush in my first election. I didn't care about politics. I was team Republican, the end. But then the day we started the war, I was in Rome at the Colosseum with a few of my friends, completely oblivious to everything going on around us. And in between us and our hotel, there were a million people that showed up to protest our country and the war that we were starting. We were literally trapped in the middle of a million people. And I had no choice, but for like 3 or 4 hours, we just watched it. And so I saw banners with pictures comparing my president to Hitler. I heard the chants, a lot of them in English, against the war, against the US. And then when we tried to go out that night, the bartenders or the bouncers wouldn't let us into the bars and the restaurants for our own safety. So that is such a pivotal moment in my life and made me go, oh my God, the world is not behind my country. Because in the American bubble, we were told that the world wanted Saddam Hussein gone. We were told that we were making the world safer. So it wasn't until I physically left and came to Europe where I went, oh, wait, I'm being lied to. Which tells me that if Russians are coming here and seeing the same things I'm seeing, which is Ukraine flags everywhere. And I saw another concert yesterday where they were raising money for Ukrainians. I haven't seen a single Russian flag. I haven't seen anything supporting the Russians whatsoever. If a Russian tourist was to come here and see all the support for Ukraine and to get into the uncomfortable conversations that they're inevitably going to have out here, you know, when they meet people, that is something they can take back to their country and go, the world is not with us. We're being lied to. But if we keep them in Russia, if we prevent them from going other places, the only person that they're going to hear from is Vladimir Putin. So I think it's so counterproductive. And I just wanted to put that out there. It's a policy that I don't support in any way. And I wish we would advocate for us to stop it.
I want to go back to your story there. A stunning element of sacrifice for the Italians back in the early aughts that they were so angry about the Iraq war, they would deny themselves the ability to bang American college students abroad. Heaton, how much do you think the people of Russia can even affect this? It's not as if, you know, we get a sense from the Russian culture, at least, that makes it over to our shores that this is necessarily anything that a pivot point through popular revolt would have much of an immediate effect. I mean, maybe a long-term one, but do you think that this is a pressure point that can be hit?
No, I don't. I think that if you're going to do pressure points, targeted sanctions might work. And they make sense to me. If you're targeting people that are higher ups in the Kremlin and the Russian Defense Ministry, that makes sense. And I would say those people are also morally culpable, justified targets of Western governmental rage and sanctions. Makes sense. And you might piss them off. And if you piss off enough of those people and you piss off enough oligarch billionaires, they might whack Vladimir Putin, and let us all hope that man is Ceausescu'd by the end of his life. And that might do something. But having people like not go to Euro Disney, having just regular Russians who have zero say on the government and are unable to actually truly vote or have their influence heard in the same meaningful ways that we do, I don't think that will have any effect. And I think, much to Jen's point, would be, in fact, very counterproductive. I want people from autocratic regimes to spend time in the West. I think that's great. Here in Edinburgh, I was talking to some people the other day, and they were slightly worried about the very large amount of students that come to my alma mater from China. And I was like, that's great. So the Chinese are giving money to the university and they get to spend time here and they get exposed to the West and maybe they'll take some of our ideas of freedom and liberty and bring it back. Like, that's good. Wonderful. I would love for more people to come over. That sounds terrific to me. With the Russians, I think that that's absolutely true. And I'll go a step further. From an ideological perspective, I think Jen nailed it pragmatically. It's much better to have free flow of information and exposure between peoples and more sources of information. But from an ideological perspective, countries don't go to war. Governments go to war. Governments go to war with each other. People don't tend to go to war with each other. I don't have any problem with some dude in Yemen right now. I've not met him. I don't know him. I have nothing to do with that. The American people don't go to war with other peoples, but our government frequently bombs them. And in the same way, I'm sure that there are a lot of crappy Russians that are like, yeah, go Russia, let's fuck up Ukraine. And that's deplorable and awful. But there's also probably a bunch of Russians that recognize that Vladimir Putin's a piece of shit and an autocrat and that Ukrainians are their neighbors and their cousins. And they want nothing to do with this business. And I don't hold them morally accountable for that. And I am very suspicious of the concept of collective guilt. I think that oftentimes runs into really, really bad oppression. And so I'm hesitant to lean into it at any point.
I think that's a good point, because when you talk about culpability, comparing my situation to the Russians, I'm from a democracy, right? So I had a hand. I directly helped elect George W. Bush. I voted for the fucker. So in a way, if you're going to punish the people for what their government does, it makes more sense to punish people like us. We're in democracies where our whole line on Vladimir Putin, I've never been to Russia, so I don't really know, but we keep saying he's a dictator and that he controls everything there. He controls the media. He controls the people. So to then say that the people are responsible for what their dictator does, I have a lot of problems with that too, because in a lot of ways they are victims as well.
And I guess this gets back to my first point, which is when the war started, we leveled economic sanctions, and then that wasn't enough working in the way that we wanted to. So it expanded, and now it's like, okay, well, we always talk about the oligarchs, and we understand that the oligarchs are very powerful in Russia. So let's seize, their business money, and then let's deny them from doing business in the West. Then it's let's seize their personal money. And let's seize any kind of property they have in the West. And all of that, as far as I can, and I'm very uneducated on these kinds of international relations and how to pressure Russia. But that happened 5.5 months ago. And so now when we're talking about let's stop the tourists from going to the beaches in Europe while the weather's nice, it seems to me that that's the bottom of the deck. I don't know how much lower we can target if now we're at the tourists, which raises a more troubling question. If you're anti intervention here between Russia and Ukraine, which are we just powerless? Is the West powerless to end this?
Maybe. I mean, I think a lot of this is exposed that we're a declining power, that the West and Europe don't have the power we thought we did. And this is bringing Russia and China closer together. So big picture, that is something that I think we have to acknowledge as Americans. Our government is not acknowledging that we are not the lone superpower in the world anymore. And so the idea that we can punish.
Well, leave us out of this one.
We're not out of this one.
This is the EU. This is the EU. Like we can take L's all day long.
We're all on the same side. Like your question was.
Yeah, but we're not talking about banning Russians from visiting America. We're talking about banning Russians from visiting the EU.
But the idea that we're at the point of banning Russian citizens from traveling does speak to the idea that the sanctions put in place by the EU and by the United States are working. And so our financial pressure that we thought was going to be so overwhelming, or at least the elites thought was going to be so overwhelming, is clearly not working. And I think short of actually getting into this war, I don't know what else there is left to do, which is why I always go back to it's time to go to negotiate the end of this, because we're not willing to get into this. What they're trying to do, economic war, isn't working. And punishing Russian citizens is only going to make them hate us. So it all leads back to the same conclusion for me, which is that this isn't going well for us.
Let's mobilize, boots on the ground. This is the only option left.
Yes.
So a few points to this, Justin, to your earlier point, Justin, of, how effective is this going to be at stopping them? I don't think that's really what's going on. Sanctions are sometimes used to affect change, but most of the time I'll argue sanctions are meant to signal to Democratic voters that you hate the things they hate. They're mostly a signaling mechanism from the elite to the base, not an actual effective method to counter governments we don't like. So I suspect in the case of our Estonian friends, that's very likely what's going on. And there's lots and lots of historical baggage between the governments of Estonia and the governments of Russia. I'm hesitant to say that we're like a defunct superpower because I shout so much about the massive spending of the military industrial complex all the time. So I'm hesitant to say that we're spending way too much money maintaining our empire and then claim that we're a defunct power at the same time. I think we're rather overextended. And in fact, we are more of a superpower than we need to be. And a pretty good example of this is how ineffective Russia has been at being able to subdue Ukraine. When this first started, I literally thought it was going to be over in a week. And that has not been the case. And I look at that and go, well, if Russia is invading Ukraine and they're very feeble at their ability to pull this off so far, that tells me that I don't need to be that worried about Russia as an American with two moats on either side of our country, that perhaps we could even scale back our military operations. We could scale back some of our defense funding and probably be just as safe as we are now.
But they're not using all their weapons again. Like they're not using the most powerful weapons that they have. The Russians have more in their arsenal. And I think you have a good point that we are spending so much money trying to maintain this empire. And we are told year after year that we need tens of billions of dollars more every year to go towards the military to continue to maintain this empire. And it's still not working. We still have Russia and China getting closer together. And we have, you know, Russia's economic, this new Silk Road and the Belt and Road and all this stuff. We're going backwards. We're not using this money to maintain an empire and getting stronger. We're spending all this money and it's still going the other way. And so I look at like, yeah, Russia wasn't able to take over Ukraine, but this war is still going on with no end in sight. So yeah, I think this speaks to our diminishing power. I really do.
And you, by we is the West here.
We, but also specifically the United States. The West doesn't patrol the entire world like we do. It's us.
Wait. So hold on. I would like both of your assistance in helping me to kind of figure this out. I'm not trying to argue with anybody here. I'm conflicted here in my assessment of what's going on in Ukraine with Russia. When Russia invaded Ukraine, I thought, I've played Risk. I know what happens when a really big country invades a small country, and that is you roll the dice a couple of times, but they inevitably take it over. That has not been the case. I thought it was going to be knocked out. I mean, like, are we at the point now where it's possible Ukraine is going to be able to knock the Russians out and take their territory back? Because that would seem to change the equation a little bit from what I initially thought.
Yeah, the question, as I understand it, is, you know, take their territory back, what territory? How much of the territory and what the phase we have yet to see is in the area for which is either disputed or held by Russia. Can they run whatever form of popular referendum that amongst those people run whatever they say and say, oh, well, the people have spoken, now they're Russian. And that then becomes some part of a negotiation between those parties. So I think what has been, at least from all the stuff that I've read about it, proven is that, you know, Russia has, I think, the third largest military in the world, and it did not acquit itself particularly well in this case because they came heavier than a lot of people were thinking, and they weren't able to topple Kyiv, which they obviously wanted to. But beyond that, I don't think that this ends clean. I don't think that this ends at this point with either Russia toppling the Zelensky government or the Ukrainian forces pushing Russia back beyond the border that existed 6 months ago.
I guess the big question for me is, is this a situation where American funding, as we've been doing, and American weapon systems, as we've been providing, are giving the Ukrainians a fighting chance to repel a fascist regime from invading, which sounds good to me, or are we just dragging out the conflict and prolonging it and prolonging the death, which would be a bad thing to do, right? So that's what I'm trying to figure out is, if we give aid, military and funding wise, is that apt to help our friends in Ukraine push out the Russians? Great. Or is it just going to drag the war out and mean more corpses and destroyed cities?
Well, that's what our government, if you listen closely, has been saying, that that's kind of the goal, is to drag this out and drain Russia of its resources, of its soldiers, of its money, of its military equipment. They want this to continue. So I'm going to take them at their word at that. And I also think that when we look at what happened, that the way Russia was not able to take over Kyiv, I think looking at it as a big country trying to take over a little country is not exactly accurate here, because since 2014, it was our military that built the Ukrainian military. So they were trained by us. They were equipped by us. They were funded by us. Like, this is not some ragtag group of soldiers that were fighting back with, you know, Molotov cocktails, despite all of the stuff we saw on TV right in the beginning in Kyiv. This is a well-funded, well-armed, well-trained military, and they held their own. But are they gonna be able to take that territory back? Well, based on the last couple months where they're, you know, the fighting line is going back and forth over the course of a couple of miles, like, we seem to be at a stalemate here. So the idea that Ukraine, without us physically getting involved, is going to be able to take back all the territory, including Crimea, which has pretty much been Russian since 2014. I think it's an unrealistic goal, but if they make that the goal, then that is how this war continues. And the strategy of making it continue for as long as is needed to drain Russia, that's how you further that. You have unrealistic, unachievable goals, and it will drag on. So that's what I think is happening here. And I'm not proud to be a part of it, but that's what we seem to be fighting for.
So then, Jen, the better thing for us to be advocating then would be to say, look, Ukraine's not going to get your Crimea back. It's probably not going to get the Donbass back, but it's been able to hold the line at X place. So let's push for that being the negotiated settlement and try to end this. That would be the better thing to do.
I think so. I mean, the Minsk agreement in 2015 said there should be a level of autonomy for the Donbass region. We can go right back to that and try to achieve that. Unfortunately, there's been so much destruction in between, but we can either do that or we can accept the reality that Ukraine's probably never going to be a part of NATO and say that Ukraine in general is going to remain a neutral country and that, you know, our side will stop trying to topple the government if it chooses to partner with Russia. And I just feel like both sides, the West and the Russians, have been meddling in the Ukraine government and trying to control it. I think there needs to be true neutrality. There has to be a buffer between Russia and NATO. And Ukraine seems to be a good place to find that buffer. And the sooner we find that line and establish that line of neutrality, that's when the people stop dying. And that's what I think we need to be pushing for.
Well, let's talk about some more American foreign policy, shall we? That is the Iranian nuclear deal, which is close to revival. Iran still has its reservations about a draft deal to revive the 2015 pact that it struck with world powers. But Iranian and Western officials continued to negotiate through this week. It was the latest sign that talks to restore the deal could drag past a Monday deadline, but there is optimism that it could indeed be put together. The Iranian foreign minister said his country hoped to share its final thoughts with European officials by the end of the week. Now, this comes amidst some interesting news in the United States. First, an Iranian official Monday denied that Tehran was specifically involved in the near fatal stabbing of author Salman Rushdie, who had to be rushed to the hospital. Although Tehran did justify the attack in the Islamic Republic's first comments. The remarks by the spokesman came days after Rushdie was wounded in New York State. The writer has since been taken off a ventilator and is on the road to recovery, according to his agent. Of course, Rushdie, now 75, has faced death threats for more than 30 years over his novel, The Satanic Verses, whose description of the Prophet Muhammad was seen by some Muslims as blasphemous. In 1989, Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Khomeini, issued a fatwa, or Islamic edict, demanding the author's death. And while Iran has not focused on Rushdie in recent years, the decree does still stand. Also, a semi-official Iranian foundation posted a bounty of over $3 million for the killing of the author, although that organization has not commented on the attack. And last week, the Justice Department unsealed charges against a member of Iran's Revolutionary Guard for attempting to arrange the murder of, favorite of this podcast, National Security Advisor John Bolton. Prosecutors accused the man, who remains at large abroad, of trying to pay a U.S.-based individual $300,000 to assassinate Bolton. The charges were based on information provided by a confidential human source. So here's my question to you, Heaton. The Iran deal moves the needle on the right as something to repeal, but from my political calculus, not much on the left, and yet it has remained such a priority for the Obama and now Biden State Department. With all of this in the atmosphere, it seems like, at least politically, a fraught decision to continue to chase this. What is your sense?
I think they need to double down on that deal that we made in 2015. I think that was a smart move. The Iranian government has been pursuing a nuclear program since the Shah, They've been doing it since the 70s. They're doing it at underground sites beneath mountains that can't be hit by missiles, or if they are really, really far down there. Mossad, the Israeli
intelligence agency.
Israeli intelligence agency. I believe their data, this is 10 years ago, their data was that if we were able to knock out their critical sites with missiles, that would still be up and running and back where it was within 3 years. So my question to the people that are opposed to that deal is, what's your game plan here, guys? Like, we don't want to have a nuclear Iran. We don't want to have nuclear proliferation in the Middle East, because if Iran goes nuclear, you know who's going to want nukes too? Saudi Arabia and Iraq and other countries, and they're apt to do it. I don't want that. I think the more countries we have that have nuclear weapons, the more likely it is that we accidentally kick off World War III with an errant flock of geese or a bad day from some dictator. I don't want that at all. So what is your plan to keep Iran from going nuclear? If we're going to go John Bolton, he would say just flat out regime change. We should invade Iran, and we should install another Shah or a president that we like, or something like that. That seems like a massive, massive amount of blood that will be on the streets of Tehran and everywhere else. Not to discount the fact that a lot of our soldiers are going to die and a lot of money would go into it. So I don't think that's in any way a good decent or even practical solution to the problem. And then what would we do? Would we just indefinitely occupy Iran forever? We would just keep a military force there for 300 years in case they ever wanted to develop nukes. It's not tenable. This is not a way to do it. Or we can just fire missiles at them every 3 years at forever. None of that makes sense to me, which means ultimately you got to get them on board with not building nukes. And that means having a treaty with them. Or in the case of 2015, an executive agreement that was hammered out by the Obama administration, but not signed into law by the Senate. I still think that's the best option we have, and I don't see a better alternative to that. I suspect that the voices on the right, which, to be fair, I have not listened to in great detail over the last year, are probably doing their same rhetorical nonsense of, well, we need a better deal, and then won't really know what the details are that would make it a better deal. Seems to me that was a pretty good deal. I don't want Iran to have nukes.
I think the argument on the other side is that the way that you don't do it is by, you know, playing statecraft with a partner that is not serious about holding up their end of the bargain. That is the argument that I have heard on that.
But the thing is that once we already have the evidence of, we had the deal with them starting in 2015, and by all measurements, they were upholding their end of the bargain. It was us that didn't hold up our end. It was Trump that pulled us out. And so politically, like, I don't give a fuck left versus right, but politically in the world, I also think that it would be good for America to keep our word. And so I do like that Biden is trying to get us back into the deal that we helped create. It's not cool for us to work out these treaties and then hire some idiot that comes in and tears them up.
Well, real quick point of order. We never signed a treaty with Iran. It was an executive agreement between Barack Obama personally and the Iranian regime. And so in that capacity, America did not violate its word or anything like that. It was just, you have an agreement for the length of this president, and that was honored. But I would love to extend it into a treaty.
I remember a bill about it. It was the JCPOA. I'm going to have to go back into my records, but the Congress was involved. I read it. It was just so many years ago.
I could be wrong here, but my thought would be if the Senate had, we would be saying a treaty rather than an executive agreement if that had been the case, which wasn't the case. They couldn't get the Republicans involved on board enough to have the Senate validate that. So I'll give a little bit of cover to the United States in this one, and that we didn't violate an agreement here, but I think we should have gone further with the agreement we had rather than making it a temporary executive handshake agreement, which is what it was. Instead, we could have ratified it into law, which we should.
Okay. I'm not sure about that.
One of the sticking points in the current negotiations is Iran wants the Iranian Revolutionary Guard taken off a list of American terrorist organizations or terrorist organizations designated by America. This is the same organization that's been linked to the possible murder attempt of John Bolton, for which, you know, however complicated the feelings on this program, I think we could all agree it would be in poor form for him to be murdered for $300,000 by the Iranian Revolutionary Guard.
They also attempted to They also attempted to blow up the Saudi ambassador to the United States at a hotel with a bomb about 5 years ago, I think, which would constitute a terrorist act.
Doesn't that factor in here? Doesn't that factor in here a little bit? Right. I get that we are playing a meta game and some of the micro elements do not matter when you get to a certain altitude. Right. And if we are just playing Risk and we are far high above the clouds and we definitely don't want a nuclear Iran, then getting that to happen no matter what is the priority. But here on Earth, these seem like ugly things, right? You know, assassination attempts and Rushdie getting stabbed in the neck.
Dude, come on. We're the country that's been drone bombing people all over the world for 20 years. We can't be like, oh, they assassinate people. We can't do a treaty with them. Like, come on. Come on. We have to behave better before we can like be like, you're bad for targeting people. Like, no.
Yes, we can be hypocrites. I submit that we can, should, and will be hypocrites.
It's not a reason not to do a treaty like that they...
I mean, look, Jen, if we judged every political action on whether or not it was morally balanced because of the actions of any one country or party, then nothing would ever get done.
That's my point precisely. That, like, Iran... Yeah, they've done bad stuff. So have we. We still don't want them to get a nuclear weapon. And again, negotiations stops the rivers of blood that Andrew was talking about.
I don't think that it's fait accompli that we invade Iran in the way that you guys seem to think. But go ahead, Andrew.
They were pushing for it for like a decade. I tend to take them at their word, the Republicans.
I for one, am not a fan of the ass backwards theocratic regime running Iran. I don't like theocracies. I certainly don't like murderous theocracies. But for that reason, I would prefer that murderous theocracy not have nuclear weapons. And I would be willing to engage. Like, this is literally Salman. Like, let's spend a moment on Salman Rushdie, that poor man, that poor, his life was ruined for writing a novel. And the offense was Muhammad was a character in the novel. I don't know whether he was pro or anti-Muhammad. I don't think it's even germane to the discussions. The fact that he depicted Muhammad was declared blasphemous, not for people that believe the religion, but for
religions.
Everyone in the world. And that the Iranian government would murder anyone. Me, the friendly, low-wattage Mr. Rogers of atheism. I should be murdered if I do. And Salman Rushdie wrote a book. His wife left him. He lived in hiding, and now he's been stabbed in his 70s. It's absolutely horrible. It's so sad that that's happening. There's bad stuff coming out of that regime. But again, that in my mind, all the more reason I don't want those nut jobs to have nukes.
I'm with him. Oh, by the way, I did take a second and I just want to make sure you guys know that Andrew wins this round. He was right. It is not a treaty, not ratified by the Senate. It's an executive agreement. So thank you, Andrew.
Yeah. So I guess the position by the majority of this panel is that the agreement was effective.
I think so.
Yeah. I think that the debate was back in the day, and I think we're probably rehashing that debate, was, you know, can this be something restrained by treaty, or must it be something through hard power and influence a la, military might or showing resolve, et cetera, et cetera. I don't think that those can ultimately be the thing. The only like non-treaty thing that was really effective was sanctions, which I'm usually very skeptical of, but this is a rare instance where sanctions were actually very effective at driving Iran to the negotiating table where they consented to this treaty that I think was a good one. And I think it was a step backwards treaty, forgive me, executive agreement. And that pulling us out of the executive agreement was a bad move. I think, Justin, to your point, we can have arguments within the American government and the State Department as to what we're going to prioritize and what we're being willing to release in terms of the negotiations. There are going to be things that we stand firm on. There are going to be things that we're willing to concede on. That's how negotiations work. But I think the main point that this side of the podcast has that I think Jen and I are on is that diplomacy still is the best tool with which to address Iranian nuclear ambitions available to us.
And again, after we had this executive agreement, we were verifying. The reports all came back that Iran was doing exactly what they said they were going to do.
Just so we're all clear that we do believe that verification was accurate.
I have no reason not to. We were looking for reasons not to trust Iran. So I have no. And also, we're not the only ones in this agreement.
Wait, who was looking for reasons not to trust Iran? Not the Obama, not the Obama administration. And then when the Republicans got into power, we pulled out.
Yes, exactly. But like that was one of the problems is that the international observers that were a part of the agreement that were going to go in and check and make sure that Iran was doing what they were supposed to do. Everything I have read said that they were doing what they were supposed to do. So I'm going to trust that because I didn't check myself.
Yeah, well, me neither.
I don't know. I've not seen the veracity of these reports. I don't really have an opinion on it, but again, I would default back to like, what's your best other alternative? I don't think regime change is a good one. And I'm not sure what the military pressure would be that would get them to agree to these things that we're like, we're going to whack another general and they go, oh, you killed another one of our generals. All right. We won't have nukes now. I don't see that happening either.
No, it seems like what our policy had been leading up to it was, you know, soft military, you know, war, the Stuxnet of it all, you know, that between our relationship with Israel, that we, the United States was doing everything that it could to hamper their development. And then, you know, the step beyond that was to say, all right, let's make this deal and you guys restrict your development in exchange for, you know, money and whatever other considerations, probably a few unprotected pick swaps that went back to Tehran. But there we go. I mean, I guess it is interesting to me that the Bolton news came out because I don't know exactly how soon all that was handled. And so like one little antenna went up for me when that happened, where it's like, okay, well this Iran deal, revival stuff has been happening in the background for a little bit, which is also weird because Russia's a major player in it. And, we are now negotiating with Russia so we can restart this deal while also demonizing Russia, I think for largely justified reasons with the war in Ukraine. But then also, so the Bolton news comes out and I'm like, I don't know. That seems weird that's something like that is getting publicized in the way that it was. But then Rushdie got stabbed in the neck and I'm like, oh, okay. This is also just maybe a coincidentally bad news that all of this is happening at the exact same time.
Well, yeah, because Rushdie was stabbed by a 24-year-old from New Jersey. It wasn't like, yeah. It wasn't an official state-sponsored thing.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, the reporting on it is still emerging. He allegedly was in contact with Iranian officials, but we do not know exactly. It wasn't like he was a member of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard.
Hmm. Although Iran's reaction was kind of wild, where they're like, we didn't do it, but he deserved it. It was his fault he got stabbed. Like it was,
exactly.
There was no right. empathy yeah. at all.
We're not taking credit, but we're certainly not disavowing.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like we didn't do it, but we do think it was awesome.
Yeah. It's like, that's almost a quote.
Yes. That was more or less a, yeah.
Yeah. They're dicks.
Yeah, I'm not going to say who it is, but one of the members of our podcast kept saying, I think I'm going to have $300,000 real soon. I should make some investments. And I was like, oh, thank God it was something unrelated. I was afraid Jen was going to murder somebody. But it wasn't the case, gang. She didn't do it. She at least didn't go through with it.
It's because my connection was a one Mr. Heaton. He's best friends with John Bolton. So how was I supposed to get to him if you wouldn't let me?
Hey, Ambassador, it's Heaton. Listen, I know we were going to go to Chuck E. Cheese's later, but my friend Jen's going to try and kill you. So I think let's do a raid check on this one, and I'll see you at the Bilderberg group meeting that you and I are going to go play tennis
Jen Briney,
at later.
Monster Slayer. I like it.
And meanwhile, he's on television as he is wont to do, saying that $300,000 is disrespect. It's disrespect that he wasn't given a higher price.
Wow. Did he really say that?
He did.
Strong move. Strong move. When Julius Caesar was captured by pirates and they offered to ransom him to his parents back in Rome, he said, no, that price is too low for me. You should double it to show his great worth. And apparently John Bolton's doing the same thing.
Patreon.com/we're not wrong is where you're going to need to go to get bonus episodes of this program. And in these, this week's episode, we are going to talk about the 1 year anniversary of the Afghanistan pullout, completing a very foreign policy heavy conversation here on We're Not Wrong. You can also email the show, we're not wrong pod@gmail.com. A house watcher writes, how does everybody feel about the likely increase in turnover in the House? Jen has advocated for firing the House multiple times. It looks like her wish is at least partially granted. Is anyone encouraged that new members may be able to legislate? We will start with you, Jen.
Well, first of all, I love the question, but I don't know why we think there's going to be more turnover in the House. Why do we think that?
Well, I suspect.
I guess if the Democrats get shellacked, there'll be incoming Republicans, maybe.
Because incumbents generally win like over 90 something percent. It's insane. So I know that some have gone down in primaries, which I'm always happy about that. But
the argument would be we're in the first cycle of a new map post-census, right? So now, A, you have the shakeup of incumbents having to run against each other and all of that chaos, plus the fact that this is a wave election, which historically at least goes against the party that's in power. So not only are you probably going to get new leadership, but you're also going to see some faces that have been there forever, like Jerry Nadler, map kerfuffle.
Did Nadler lose the primary?
No, although Maloney has now made the race more about whether or not Joe Biden is going to run for re-election because she said it in a debate.
Why'd she do that?
Well, no. And then apparently, I think it was with the New York Times editorial board, she tried to go off the record in the middle of her interview. And so they were asking her about Joe Biden and she goes, off the record, he's not running. And they're like, that's not how off the record works. It's not a magic spell. You can't just like cast it and then say whatever you want and have us not run it. You have to have us agree that this is going to be off the record. And then we take it off the record. And then she's like, oh, on the record, I don't think he should run. But she is out here telling the New York Times that he's not going to run. So who knows? Who knows? Who knows what's going to happen in that race? It has not happened yet, but it does look like she is in position to beat Nadler.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess if we're just talking theoretically, I do like the idea of turnover in Congress, but it matters who the turnover is. So if we end up in this wave election and we end up with Republican rule and we have more in like the Kevin McCarthy, Trump loving crazy brand, like that's a bad thing. Like I really want us to hire people that are interested in governing, that don't think that government is the problem and make it their job to tear it down and defund everything and just serve as government wrecking balls. And so as much as I like the idea of turnover, I like the idea of carefully selecting our representatives more. So I don't know. I don't really have an answer for that. I think it just depends on what the new makeup of the Congress is, whether or not I'll be excited about it.
So Speaker of the House, Kevin McCarthy, and Minority Leader Adam Schiff does not do it for you.
Oh my God. I can't even fathom how horrible that would be. I'm sweating. Like you just gave me heart palpitations. Like, please don't do this.
Heaton, throw them all out. Yay or nay.
It's not going to make a difference. we live under this illusion that the problem is that if there are bad people running the government, but if only we had good people running the government, things, if you put good people in a bad system, you still get a bad outcome. The problem here is that we have a fundamentally bad system. We really need electoral reform. We have a system that makes it difficult to govern. We have a system that pushes extremism and pushes partisanship and punishes bipartisan agreements. And that's baked in. Like we're talking about putting in hot water or cold water into plumbing that doesn't work. So having turnover without the system itself changing, without the institution changing, the Republicans will get to do something that pisses off the Democrats, and there'll be one or two things that happen. But no, I don't think the system's going to fundamentally change just by quote unquote throwing the bums out. You got to change the system itself.
I disagree with that completely.
So when you say system, let's be specific. What elements of the system, at least in the House specifically, is corrosive?
Well, here's one. Quit having chairmanships doled out based on who gives the most money to the party. That's a really bad way to run the system. The reason that
that's not our system. Yeah, that's not the way the House of Representatives is supposed to be run based on the Constitution. That's the parties that chose to do that. That's not our system.
Okay, when I'm talking about the system, I'm just talking about the system of governance, not necessarily the constitutional order that's undergirding it. The system that we have right now in terms of the function, the apparatus of government, is that chairmanships are handed out at the discretion of the speaker, and the speaker in both parties, going back to Gingrich and a little bit before that, tends to pass them out based on who does really good fundraising, which means that every single member of Congress, if they want to get ahead and they want to do well and get on a committee they want, and they want to have a chairmanship on that committee, they need to be fundraising constantly. So that's like a basic thing we could do that would not even require a constitutional amendment, because it is how the parties are internally doing it. Congress has the ability tomorrow to change that. It wouldn't have to consult with anybody. The president didn't have to be involved. That's a fundamental thing that would be good for the system. We talked last week about electoral reform that would be welcome in terms of open primaries, in terms of ranked choice voting, things like that. The current elective order that we have is one which facilitates binary thinking and rewards placating your base rather than actually serving the entirety of your constituency, and penalizes bipartisan agreements. So like, so long as those fundamental building blocks are in place, you're going to keep getting Republicans that are to the right of the Republican Party and Democrats that are to the left of the Democratic Party with no incentives to work with each other. So like the incentive structure is not changing. So I don't think that much will change unless the incentive structure itself is altered.
Stick up for the bums, Jen.
Well, no, it's not. No, I hear what he's saying now. Like, the political system is gross and everything that you said is completely justified, and I agree with it. But I think that we have to be very careful in distinguishing between the political system and the government system, because our government system is not the problem. Our system of having Congress make the laws and the executive branch enforce the laws, like our basic structure that the Constitution gave us, I actually very much believe in. And what happens when we have these conversations, we blame the system, and we have an entire party now that has bought into the idea that government itself, the system of government, is problematic. Everything should be privatized. And so they go in there, and instead of having the goal of effective government, they have the goal of tearing the government down and eliminating departments and defunding things and making it ineffective so the private sector can do those jobs instead. And that I think we need to distinguish, because how we elect these people is how we get people into government that have the goal of effective government. So you're absolutely right that the political system has to change. But we have to be careful when we say the system, because a lot of people hear the system and they blame the government itself as the problem. But no society can function without an effective government. So that's, I think that's where you and I were.
Well, I think a basic part of governance is just, I think this is largely a wording difference. I'm not bothered so much by these terms, so I'm happy to accommodate as necessary. And so far as that goes, like, sometimes the private sector does better, sometimes the public sector does better. The nature of governance is being able to determine what should the private sector be handling, what should the public sector be handling.
Absolutely.
And I'll say, and Jen, you're not saying this, so you don't think you're saying this, but one of the criticisms that I have towards a lot of my progressive Democrat friends is this idea that there's this sort of Manichaean battle against Republicans versus Democrats. And because the Republicans are so anti-government, we can just never vote for them ever. And I read, because I am not a binary thinker, I reject that as well, of like, I would love for there to be more sane Republicans in government. I would love for there to be more sane Republicans. I would love for there to be more Democrats that have a good understanding of economics participating in this. And so what I'm trying to do, and what I do on the Political Orphanage quite a lot, is try to figure out, like, well, how do we reform the system, however we want to define it, in such a way that it's going to produce these optimal outcomes that both better represent the people and lead to better outcomes.
Yeah, you're right that that's not, like, when it comes to Republicans, I would vote for a Republican that actually was fiscally responsible and anti-war and did the things when in power that they say that they're going to do. But what I have witnessed over my 10 years of doing Congressional Dish is that the party has been taken over by really the Tea Party wing, is where I started seeing this get really crazy, where instead of having the conversation of what is more appropriate for this task, the private or public sector, there is a reflexive, it's always private sector with a lot of these people in the Republican Party. So that mature conversation of like what should be done in house, like what's the most efficient, that's not what's happening. It is privatization is always good. And it's led to our government being dysfunctional, because if you are hiring people to run it that don't think it can run well, well, this is what you get. And as far as the Democrats are concerned, they're a much wider party. Like, they're not in lockstep the way that the Republicans are on a lot of things. So, yeah, I just, when I look at these, the turnover of the House, I think, Andrew, like, you really nailed it, where until we have a political system that doesn't reward the most extreme people, we're not going to get the type of governing that I'm looking for, where the goal is effective government and not these easy to slogan solutions to everything.
The only point I would make to you, Jen, is that yes, we can intellectually separate government from politics, but the way we elect our people to govern is political. It is by a democracy, right? So these laws of physics have to apply unless we change the system. And I would advocate that we could change the system to a child fatal battle royale, like in Hunger Games. And those are our representatives. And then they make the decision, scarred by the PTSD of this dystopian contest.
Excellent idea. I think we've solved all our problems.
Nailed it. And finally, a red stater writes, Jen's reaction to Iowans getting to vote is why Republicans win. There were a few comments that came in. This was the most succinct, so that's what I ran with. Do you have anything else to say on your defense of coastal elitism?
I apologized twice. I got ranty and said some things I didn't mean. This is the last apology you're getting from me. I apologized twice. Basically, that frustration came from someone who's my entire life voted in California where my vote didn't matter, and I resent it. And so that's what that was. I got emotional and mean, and I'm sorry.
You know, I do think it is fascinating.
I apologize for nothing to the morning people. You morning people lord it over us. Here's another thing. How about this? I go to sleep late. Do you know what I do when somebody's sleeping in my place? I don't make a lot of noise. Somebody's sleeping. I'm not going to wake up. Morning people wake up. Oh, they're slamming glasses. They're opening doors. They're shutting doors. They're talking, because we should be awake because we're lazy, aren't we? Morning people coming after you. I apologize for nothing.
Who hurt you? What morning person hurt you? That's what I want to know.
Society.
It's not society. It's you. You're unhinged.
By the way, this is the second time I've heard this morning person rant. He was a little tipsy in Berlin, and we walked for like a mile where he was just ranting about morning people. Like, he really feels all this.
Oh, no. Yeah.
I feel all of this. Beaches and morning people.
Because I wake up. I mean, look, I'm a bit of a morning person. I wake up a little early in the morning, and like I definitely get, I've gotten drive-by shade from Heaton, where like if we like meet up around 10, like Heaton will just be like, oh, I'm sure you already did your taxes. I'm sure you've already gone out and bought a house, sold a house, and you know, you are very gruff.
All right. You know what? Okay, here's where I will back down. There's a subset of morning people. There's a tiny group of morning people who truly do believe, though, that it's just because they're better people and they should be allowed to wake me up whatever they want. And also everyone in the world should accommodate that particular, but that tiny group of people that are a subset of morning people are the ones that piss me off. Everybody else, I love you. Justin, I love you. I'm definitely more of a dick about it than you are. I definitely create more problems than you do, for sure. Thank you for waking up early to accommodate me and Jen, who are coming over here from Europe. We appreciate that.
Yeah, that is that. I mean, like, yeah, I'm the one who's up at 6 o'clock in the morning so I can get everything ready so we can do this while you guys are on European time. You have a yeah. leisurely European schedule where you get to work at 3 o'clock in the afternoon.
Well, we could do it late. It's just I'll be drunk. Like I'm in the fucking high plains
driving 2 hours from fucking Denver to Cheyenne so I can also do this show and not go out and cover the shit that I should be covering. So you're welcome.
I'm staying out of it.
Fucking late riser privilege. All right, there we go. That is it. We're Not Wrong is a production of Dog and Pony Show.
I'm curious to see the backlash on this one.
Our editor is
curious to see if this ends my career. It might be the one.
The mighty Will Saddleberg. Jen, what are you working on?
I don't remember. Oh,
well, you're gonna be at Podcast Movement, right?
Yes, I am doing the orientation at Podcast Movement. And I keep talking about this 9/11 or not 9/11, the Burn Pits bill for the veterans.
Yep.
And I had to push it a week because we have authorized so many different categories of veterans to get healthcare benefits. And so I went down all the rabbit holes like, oh, what happened on this island that makes sure that we need to give these guys healthcare? And it was just one story after another, after another. So I got super deep on it. I'm almost done with this. It will be recorded this week. But yeah, this is the episode that will not end because it was just so many rabbit holes. We've poisoned so many of our veterans. So yeah, that'll be the next episode of Congressional Dish. And then Chips is next.
Yeah. So you went way deep on the military stories, huh? Your regular Dan Carlin.
I just couldn't let it go. You know, it was like, these guys on this atoll in 1968, which tells me that for 50 years they haven't been getting healthcare. So it was like, what were we trying to cover up? And it turns out we were covering up a lot of shit. So I just can't help myself when I find this stuff in the bills. I can't just like go buy it and not look into it. And there were so many of them.
I think that's the reason why you do an amazing show. Heaton, the orphanage continues.
It trundles along. Yeah. We just did another judge week. I mentioned last week, I was very, very happy with it. I'm very happy. I had multiple attorneys reach out to tell me what a good job I did, which I was really flattered by. Usually people don't like attorneys. I like attorneys. They're fun and you can argue with them and then they'll make out with you because they can separate stuff. So the attorneys are good people. Judge week was fun. Covered lots of stuff involving the First Amendment, the establishment.
Andrew, the lawyer kisser Heaton.
It is a running theme on this show.
No, but I was flattered though.
It is. He wants to kiss a lawyer.
Well, okay.
It's just kiss lawyers. It sounds
it's
like
just
it.
A joke about the fact that most people, like, a lot of people now lack the ability to argue and stay friends. Right. And I find that attorneys are sort of inoculated against that. And it's nice. Judge week was good. Establishment clause, free exercise clause. Listen to Judge week for the rest of your life. You will have a basic framework of how to adjudicate church state relations when they pop up. Whenever you hear somebody getting mad about a Supreme Court case that involves prayer in schools or putting a cross on the lawn of a Capitol, something like that. If you listen to the political orphanage last week, we go over it. You'll be able to articulate your position and explain why and understand what the battle lines are. It was a lot of fun. I just got off the phone with Lori Garver prior to speaking to you all by seconds. Lori Garver was the number two at NASA when NASA began doing private-public partnerships with Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos, et cetera, et cetera. So she's, in my opinion, kind of the linchpin character in terms of being able to open up space exploration to the private sector and getting the private sector involved. And I think she's amazing. I think she's a wonderful example of an administrator that's very pragmatic and understands incentives. And we had a great conversation about that. And I was able to talk to her about kind of the ideal format of encouraging innovation in terms of what should the public sector be doing? What should the private sector be doing? And that'll be this week on the Political Orphanage.
You know, it's so funny that debate and the nomenclature that goes in there, because to say that like we opened it up to the private sector would make you believe that NASA in a previous world were in the NASA shed with NASA parts building rockets and space shuttles, when in reality, they were, you know, working with Northrop Grumman and Lockheed Martin and all these companies that are private sector companies. The difference was going away from just the NASA saying, okay, make this to order, and instead being allowed to take off the rack parts that were being created by SpaceX and Blue Origin and all that.
Well, it's that, and there was also a launch monopoly for a while, where the only companies that could launch were through United Launch Alliance,
which is all those companies I just said in one group.
Right. It's just basically all of the defense contractors that NASA was employing at congressional behest, oftentimes to further jobs in their particular district. Those companies were the only ones that were allowed to participate. And on their end, they would all go, but if we drag our feet on this and claim it costs more, you'll just keep paying us year after year, because there's literally no incentive for us to do this in an efficient manner. And I think Lori was very good at being able to identify that and go, how can we get markets to work for us and open that up? It's a good discussion. I was very excited to talk to her.
On the PX3 program, you're going to hear the fall of the House Cheney. I'm here in Cheyenne to presumably watch the end of Liz Cheney's congressional career, as Harriet Hegeman is probably going to beat her. But also, I think it is a pivotal moment in American politics, as the career of Dick Cheney and his daughter Liz is something that I think is worthwhile to understand and follow as it possibly takes either another direction or ends entirely. So you can find that on the Politics, Politics, Politics program.
I hope she wins and it fucks up all the work you've been doing ahead of time.
Why would you wish ill upon me? Why would you say something so ugly to me, Jen? That's it. Next
because
episode.
I like watching you rant. It's so fun.
No, I mean, I do think I would have to change the title. It wouldn't be the fall of House Cheney anymore. But I think my larger point kind of holds. And the point I want to make is political parties are about wins, dynasties, whether they be in sports or in ancient history, are all built on winning. In pivotal moments, you've come through. And I think more than the ideological question of where Trump fits in all this and whether Trump did X, Y, or Z, or is the party moving in an unsustainable direction, at the end of the day, you've got to be on the side of winning. And there are some Republicans who have been blistered by Trump that have won. If Liz Cheney is not one of them, I think this is less an ideological issue and more of a nuts and bolts, X's and O's. Are you winning and benefiting your gang, or are you losing and not? And that is what we will explore here. If she does win, though, I will have to totally reshape the entire episode. But I'm rolling the dice here. I like to live dangerously, and maybe this will be a hilarious moment when the upset of the century happens later tonight in the high plains of Cheyenne.
Yeah, it's kind of, I feel dirty though. I just said I wanted a Cheney to win. Now I need to take a shower.
I'm telling you, she's going to run for president on the Democratic side. that about wraps it up for us. For Jen Briney and Andrew Heaton, I'm Justin Robert Young. We're not wrong.
Dog and Pony Show Audio.